The Feynman Lectures on Physics. This lecture was presented by Dr. Richard Feynman on May 8, 1962 at the California Institute of Technology. Volume 1, Chapter 45, Illustrations of Thermodynamics. Section 45.1, Internal Energy.
The subject of thermodynamics, which we discussed last time as far as deriving the principles of the second law, when it comes to applications, is a rather difficult, complex subject. And it isn't really proper for us to go very far into it. It's too difficult to keep track of all of the things. I'll tell you essentially why it's difficult in a moment. But I would like to say that we don't have another course in thermodynamics in the physics department except the graduate course. But the subject is, of course, of very great importance to engineers and chemists. And so if you're interested in this subject, you can learn about it in physical chemistry or in the applications of thermodynamics in physical chemistry or in engineering thermodynamics. If you're interested enough, there's a good reference book, Zamansky's book in thermodynamics. If you have the Encyclopedia Britannica 14th edition at home, then you can read the articles on thermodynamics, heat, thermochemistry, the article on chemistry section, physical chemistry, heat and vaporization, liquefaction of gases, and so forth. There's quite a number of articles. That's how I, as a matter of fact, prepare all these lectures. I read the Encyclopedia Britannica, and then I tell you what's in it. The subject is complicated because there are so many different ways of describing the same thing. If we talk about a gas in which we could say that the pressure depends upon the temperature and on the volume, or we could say the volume depends on the temperature and the pressure. And then there's the internal energy, which might depend upon the temperature and volume, if that's the variables that you've chosen. But you could also consider that this depends on the temperature and pressure, or the pressure and volume, and so on. And we've just discussed the existence of still another function of temperature and volume last time called the entropy. Naturally, we can make various combinations. If I take U to minus T times S or something, that's also a function of temperature and volume. And so we have a large number of different quantities, which can be functions of many different combinations. You could consider U, the internal energy, as a function of the entropy and the pressure, if you wanted to. And so you get all kinds of interrelationships from that. Therefore, in order to keep the subject simple in this lecture, and not to derive all of the possible interrelations of everything else, otherwise you get kind of lost in a sea of possibilities, the best thing to do is to make up your mind what variables you're going to use from the beginning as the free variables. The chemists choose the temperature and the pressure because the experiments are easier done that way. But in order to be as most straightforward and to come most quickly from the thermodynamics without inventing too many new things, I'm going to use temperature and volume throughout this lecture, except in one place where I'll tell you the trick by which we can cross over into the chemists' notations. But that is an example of how you go to another system. But we will first then hold only one system of variables. And second, we will only discuss two of the functions, the internal energy and the pressure. All the others can be derived from those. All the other combinations can be made out. And so it isn't necessary to discuss them necessarily. That is, it is interesting and it's useful. It simplifies one equation, makes more complicated another. But what I'm going to do then is to limit myself to pressures and internal energies and use as the variables, temperature and volume. Now, with that limitation, it's still a fairly difficult subject, but it isn't quite so impossible. Now, in order to do this, I would like to remind you of something in mathematics. If a quantity is a function of two variables, then the idea of the derivative requires just a little bit more careful thought. What is the derivative of the pressure with respect to the temperature? What I mean by that could mean various things. You see, the temperature might change and the volume might change. For instance, if I heat it up, it might be expanding, say, and the temperature is changing and the volume is changing. How much does the pressure change? Well, there are two kinds of derivatives that we're going to be involved in. One is a derivative in which we consider the volume as constant. How much does the pressure change if the temperature only changes? And that's an ordinary derivative which you would be inclined to write as dP dt. Except as a warning signal to the fact that the P also depends upon something else, and we imply that that other thing is kept constant. mathematicians have instead written the derivative instead of a D as a 6 backwards. So that this symbol is what they would use to say the derivative of pressure with respect to temperature, warning, all other variables on which it could depend are kept constant. In this case, there's only one other variable, the volume. Now, in our work here in thermodynamics, because of the complexities, I'm going to do a double take, so to speak, on a notation. I'm not only going to write this hook thing, this backward 6, to remind you that it is something else is being kept constant, but I'm going to be very explicit on what's kept constant. So I put a little parenthesis and put a V down there. That just is a reminder that it's V that's being kept constant, so that if you compare these equations to some other equation in some other book, it may be they're taking the derivative when the entropy remains constant or the internal energy. So watch out. So I'm telling you that this means that in our case, we have the volume constant. So in all the derivatives, I'll always mark what it is that's constant, which is a redundant notation, but is necessary in order to keep your wits in this rather jungle-like mess of possibilities. For you, I have written here, I suppose, something that you all know, but perhaps you don't, so I'll very quickly talk about it. It's the following. Whenever there's, let's suppose that we have a function, f, which depends upon two quantities, x and y. It's like p depends on t and v. Then, by the derivative of f with respect to x, keeping y constant, the mathematicians don't bother with that extra nonsense, so you don't see that, but let's suppose I put that in. I would mean the way you take an ordinary derivative. You change x to x plus dx, and you take away what you had before, leaving y fixed throughout the entire analysis. Divide by the dx and take the limit. That's what I mean. It's just a derivative, only I think of y as constant. And when you differentiate a combination of x's and y's, like x squared, for instance, plus xy, if this is f of x, then the derivative of f x and y, rather, of f with respect to x is equal to 2x plus y. Because I just think of y as a constant. In the same manner, I can differentiate y, changing y, taking the limit, and so on. And the way to calculate it, never mind the definition, is to differentiate this in the ordinary way. Only this time x is a constant, and if x is a constant, the derivative of that is 0, and the derivative of that is x. So these are two relations. Incidentally, we won't need it here, but it's very entertaining and very useful fact. And I don't need it all here, but I will tell you about it. You can differentiate, of course, again. You could differentiate the derivative with respect to y of f again. That means the secondary with respect to y, keeping x constant. But you can also do other combinations. You can differentiate the derivative of y with respect to x. For instance, in this case, the answer would be 1. Or you could differentiate with respect to y the derivative of f with respect to x. You know, we first differentiate with respect to x, and then that done, we differentiate with respect to y. The answer in this particular problem happens to also be 1. In this problem, they come out equal. Well, they come out equal in all problems. Those two things are exactly the same. You may try to prove it to yourself. It's an amusing fact and a rather important one, but we're not going to need it in this lecture. The derivatives don't depend on the order. However, what we do need in this lecture is the following. This tells, if we have an ordinary derivative, then the change, if you have an ordinary function of one variable, and the variable changes, then the change in the function is equal to the derivative multiplied by the change in x, a famous useful use of the derivative. We would like to get the generalization of that when there's more than one variable. In short, suppose that both x and y change together. That is, when something happens, x changes to x plus delta x, and y changes to y plus delta y. Problem is, what is the change in f? In the limiting case, of course, as physicists always do, that the delta x and the delta y are infinitesimal. Then the change in f is the difference between f of x plus delta x and y plus delta y. Take away f of x and y. Now, what I want you to notice is that this is the same as the change in x times the derivative of f with respect to x, that is the change that would occur if y didn't change, plus the change that would occur if x didn't change, which is delta y df dy. So the fundamental law involved is the equation across here. From this equal delta f. That's needed in the limit, of course, when they're all very small. How do you prove that? I've written a proof down here if you can't make up one for yourself. And you can see if you can follow the proof sometime when you go home or worry about it. It's very easy. You can make up one of your own. But there we are. Now, I mean, it's easy to believe that if you change both, it's the change due to one plus the change due to the other variable that you change. So, okay? So, for instance, take an example of our pressures and volumes and internal energies. You would have the following. We could have, if we changed the temperature and the volume, you might ask yourself, how much does that internal energy change for small changes? Of volume alone, it would be the rate of change of the volume of the energy with respect to volume. Well, I keep the temperature constant. That's always implied with my saying it's T and V. That would be the change due to change in volume. But if you also happen to a system in which both the volume and the temperature change, then you would have this situation. First, for instance, suppose the volume doesn't change and only the temperature changes. Well, wait, just before, excuse me, just a moment. I would like to remind you that the changes in energy is also, according to the thermodynamics, is the heat that's put in minus the work that's done in a particular way. So you would be at first inclined to think, I see, P is du dV. That is not right, because you still have to figure out how much heat goes in when you change the volume a little bit. You see, if you change the volume a little bit, heat can go in. Say if you did it isothermally, which is what this is. If the temperature changes zero, then we're asking for the change in U. When we change U, some heat goes in and some work is done. So it's a little more complicated. And in order to get it straightened out, I'll show you two things. First, let's suppose that we keep volume constant and see how much U changes according to this. Well, if we keep the volume constant, this term is zero. And the change in U is the same as the change in the heat. And so if we keep the volume constant and we want the change in U when we change the temperature, the rate of change of U with temperature at constant volume, that's always put into the mind. That's the amount of heat we'd have to put in to change the temperature. Now, there's a name for that. How much heat do you put into a substance to change the temperature per degree? That's called a specific heat, and sometimes it's called C sub V, or anyway, it's a specific heat. At constant volume, you might prefer to heat it up on constant pressure. Well, that's your business, then you have to figure out what to do, but we're doing temperature and volume. So this is a specific heat at constant volume. So I know what du dt is. Du dt at constant V is a specific heat at constant volume. But now let's say that we keep the temperature constant, that's isothermal, and we change the volume. Then the change in U is more complicated. The change in U when we change the volume would be first the heat needed to change the volume by delta V if I kept the temperature constant, divided by delta V, minus the work. P, you see, I divide by delta V. So that the rate of change of U with respect to V at constant temperature is not minus P. Why? Because at constant temperature, when I let it expand, it would, if I didn't let any heat in, cool off. I mean, excuse me. If I let it expand, the work done would be P dV. And if I didn't let any heat in, it would cool off. And so in order to restore the temperature, because I said I wanted a constant temperature, I got to pour some heat in. So before I get the correct value for the UDV, it's not just the P part, but it's also the heat needed to change the volume by delta V, keeping the to keep the temperature constant. And now it turns out that we can calculate by the argument of Carnot, this. And this, when I calculate this by the argument of Carnot, I will be telling you all the laws of thermodynamics. See, all this shenanigans here, this one here is the first law, so everything I have here is consistent with the first law, and that's all there is. The only thing that the second law is going to do is it's going to give us an answer for this. And so I argue I want to show you how that goes. We've talked about the Carnot cycle in which we made an isothermal expansion, then an adiabatic expansion, then isothermal compression. Adiabatic compression went around a cycle. We also know that the total amount of work done in a reversible cycle is equal to the heat that's taken out at the hot side. Let's say the heat taken out in this experiment, the delta Q, say. The heat taken out in the hot end of the isothermal expansion times the temperature difference over the temperature. You remember the formula that the work that we derived last time was the heat over the temperature at the top times the temperature difference. If the temperature difference is, we're going to do this now for an infinitesimal cycle in which the temperature difference is very small, then the work done will be equal to the heat taken out over here times delta T over T. That's the same formula for a small difference in temperature. Now, I would like to point out that the work done is equal to the area that's shaded in this figure. The reason is the following, that the work done under any circumstances is the integral of P dV. And if I make a plot of pressure against volume, it's like y against x, it's integral y dx is the area. So that the work done in going along from here to here would be the area under here. And the work done in the adiabatic expansion is the area under this funny trapezoidal thing. So that the total work done in going from here to here is all this area underneath the top part of the curve. But now when I climb back across here, I put work back in, and the work I put back in is this area and must be now counted negative. And the work that I put back in when I go up here is this area here, which is again counted negative. So therefore, I want the area under the top thing minus the area under the bottom thing. We just subtract, you get that part left over. So the area in that shaded region, that is the work done. Now I'm going to find that area away by geometry. Since the temperatures are very close and the adiabatics are very near each other because the volume change is small, everything are straight lines. And this is a parallelogram. So I have chosen to calculate the area a different way. I drop a straight line down here from this point to this point and measure this difference. It's a change in pressure. Notice it's a change in pressure at constant volume that would accompany a change in temperature. Well, we'll see that in a minute. And let's call the distance from here to here between these two points horizontally the delta V. I want to argue that the delta P times delta V, the rectangle, the yellow rectangle, would be equal to the same as the crazy parallelepiped. It takes a few minutes to figure that out. First of all, you can see that if I change from the blue lines to the yellow lines, the area is unchanged because I gained this triangle and I lost that triangle, and they're obviously equal. We can prove it somehow. So therefore, I have this. Now, between these same parallels, I just push that. I don't know, there's a rule that if you take the height of a parallelogram times its base, you get the area. Anyway, it's delta P delta V. You sit down and think about it. Therefore, I write this all over again as follows. I'm going to write the same equation here, only I'm going to write a little bit more carefully what each quantity is. First, delta T over T, that's this factor, times the heat out. That heat is the heat that's needed when the volume changes by delta V and the temperature remains constant. So this is the heat needed to change the volume by delta V at constant temperature. On the other side, we have delta V times delta P. Delta V I left alone, but I want to say what delta P is because it's not which one of these lines it is. Delta P is the difference in pressure which accompanies a change in temperature when the volume doesn't change. So delta P is the change in pressure when the temperature changes by delta T, although the volume is kept constant. Well, just throwing the delta T's and stuff around, that's equivalent to this. They left the heat form the same. Heat needed to change volume by delta V per delta V, keeping the temperature constant, is equal to T times dP dT at constant V, because that's what the derivative means. How much would the pressure change if you change the temperature and kept the volume constant? That's the rate of change of pressure with temperature, keeping the volume constant. That is better when I divide by delta T, it is. The change in the pressure when I change delta T divided by delta T is the derivative. And the derivative is taken at constant volume, hence the backward sixes and a little sub V. This thing, which I've written in the square, is a summary of, contains all the stuff that's involved in Carnot's arguments. And everything that comes in thermodynamics can be deduced from this plus the first law. This is the second law. In fact, this was deduced in this form essentially. A slightly different definition of temp. The definition of temperature wasn't available, so he had a slightly different form, but the idea is the same. This was derived by Carnot originally, as a conclusion from his arguments. And so the secret thing is, I wanted to try to find one thing, which was the guts of the thermodynamics, that you don't have to, if you can hold on to this one, then all the others will be ground out by sheer mathematics. This one, not by mathematics, but by arguments about the Carnot cycle. We've already seen that that combination, that object is here, is when we combine with the first law, is just what we need to find a derivative of u with respect to v. Because we argued before that when we changed, well, let's give the argument over again. How much would the internal energy change if we changed the volume by delta v? I mean, I could have left the formula here, but I want to go just one step further. How much would the internal energy change if I changed the volume by delta v? First, it changes because heat's put in, and second, it changes because work is done. Well, the heat that's put in from delta v is this. Here, if I get this formula, is delta v times this. Delta v times this thing. And the work is delta v times p. So therefore, the change in internal energy has two pieces. It has the T delta P from the heat part, and it has P from the work part. And therefore, if I divide both sides by delta V, I get the rate of change of U with V at constant T is equal to T times dP dT at constant V minus P. Now, it's written very small on the blackboard because I didn't have any room. It should be written on the whole blackboard, so you can, that's the whole thing. Because if we stick to this, that we're going to talk about pressures and internal energies and variables U and V, on T and V only, then this is it. There's nothing else to do. I mean, this is the whole consequence of thermodynamics.
Section 45.2, applications.
Now let's discuss it's a little elaborate, but let's discuss the meaning of it and why it answers the questions which we proposed last time. First, we were worried about the following thing, that in kinetic theory it was perfectly obvious that if, because of the bombardment of the atoms on the piston, that if we increase the temperature, the pressure would increase. But at the same time, for the same physical reason, when we'd let the piston go back, heat would be taken out. Or in order to keep the temperature constant, heat would have to be put in. It cools when it expands, and the pressure rises when you heat it up, and there must be some connection between those two, we hoped. And here we have a connection, because here it is. It says, how much the pressure would change with temperature if you kept the volume fixed. You hold the volume fixed and heat her up. I mean, increase the temperature. The pressure rises by a certain amount. Related to that is this. If you want to change the volume, and it'll cool unless you pour some heat in to maintain the temperature. And this is the amount of heat you need to maintain the temperature. So this interrelationship is the fundamental interrelationship between those two effects, and that was what I guaranteed you we would find when we got the laws of thermodynamics. So without knowing the internal mechanism of the gas, but only knowing that we can't make perpetual motion of Carnot's type, or the second type sometimes, then we can deduce the relationship between how much heat's needed to maintain the volume, to maintain the temperature when it expands, and how much the pressure rises when we heat it up. Now, that is then the result that we wanted, but we didn't only have the case of a gas, we also had the case of a rubber band. And the same situation was involved in a rubber band. When we stretched the rubber band, we found that the temperature fell, and when we heated the rubber band, we found that it pulled itself in. So we'd like to get that relationship for the rubber band now instead of just the gas. Now, for a rubber band, the situation would be something like this, that changes in internal energy would be involved when you put heat in, and also work. The only difference is that the formula for the work done on a rubber band is not PdV, but is the force on the band, which depends on how long it is, and the temperature, and the distance, the length of the band. So let L be the length of the band, and F be the force by which it pulls. This force is a function of the temperature and the length of the band. So in here, we would have the force times the differential length. That's the work done on the band. Compare this, then, with the original one that we were doing for the gas, which was like this. Then we see that, of course, it's merely a substitution of one letter for another. The arguments will all go through exactly the same. If V is changed to L in the theory of gases, and if the letter P is changed to the minus F, then we will be discussing your rubber band. And instead of being a function of T and V, because V is L, it's just T and L. No? So therefore, we can immediately deduce for a rubber band, for instance, that the heat needed to change the length by delta L per unit delta L is equal to minus the temperature times the rate of change of the force by which it pulls when you change the temperature, if you keep the length constant. In short, therefore, if I hold the length of the rubber band and I heat it up a little bit, I can tell you how much the force will increase, or at least I relate that to how much heat I would need to keep the length constant, no, to change the length, when I change the length a little bit in order to keep, to bring the temperature back, to keep the temperature constant. So you see, it doesn't make any difference. It's the same equation again. In fact, if you could write du is equal to dq plus a db, you see, where a and b are things for a depend on different problems, magnetic field and permeability or something or other. At any rate, a and b have two different things, force and length, pressure and volume, electric field on a battery, and the charge that goes through the battery. Let's call a charge z. I would hate to call a charge q. We got Q for the heat. We got enough trouble already. So we call a charge Z. Then I claim that we can deduce from the fact that the work done in a battery when you move a charge through it, a reversible electric cell like a storage battery, can go either way. So it's got to be reversible. The theories don't work. Why? Then the theory will tell us this, that, well, let's take it in this form just for fun, just as the same thing. The rate of change of the internal energy when you move a certain amount of charge through the cell, provided you maintain constant temperature, is equal to minus T times dE dt at constant charge minus E. Now, what's that say? It says that the internal energy that's changed when a certain charge moves through the cell. Incidentally, when the charge moves through the cell, some chemical reactions occur. And so this is a nitsy way of measuring how much energy is required to produce a certain chemical reaction. All you have to do is make it into a cell that works on that reaction, measure the voltage, and also measure how much the voltage changes when you keep the charge constant. It also turns out that it's necessary to keep, we didn't talk about the volume in here, but since we didn't add any work for the PDV in case it could expand, there's more variables this time. We have also to keep the volume constant because we didn't add any term for the work done by the volume. So we keep the volume constant. There's no such a term. So here it is, dE dt at constant volume minus E. At first, you might think it's surprising. It's usual to think that when you take a certain energy out of a battery or put a charge into a battery, the work you do is the charge times the electric field. And so why isn't the change in the energy when I move a little bit charge just the voltage on the battery? The answer is that if I really did it with an honest, real battery, when I move the charge through the battery, I generate some energy, I generate some heat. And this says to do the thing at constant temperature, so the whole thing is in a bath. So then when I move the charge about, and not only do I get the work because of the electrical work, but the whole battery gets heated up. So the internal energy of the battery is changed not only because it did work on the outside circuit, but also because it's heated up. And the remarkable thing is that the heat part can be expressed again in terms of the way that the battery voltage changes with temperature. Now you see, to find the energy differences in chemical reactions, all we have to do is build a cell, measure the voltage, and measure how the voltage changes with temperature when we don't take any discharge, but keep the volume constant. Now, it turns out that this is technically quite difficult. It's damn hard to hold the cell at constant volume. It's much easier to just have the cell in the atmosphere and measure how much the voltage changes when you change the pressure. And for that reason, the chemists don't like any of the equations that I'm writing here. They want all the equations to be with constant pressure. And I told you that I was not going to use any other pair of variables but T and V. However, for this one sub-part, I will tell you how the trick is, a gimmick, by which every equation that we write with volumes and U can be shifted about so as to be one for the chemistry. In other words, for one for T and P. I will show you the trick, but remember, on this blackboard, confusion can easily set in because I'm shifting gears from T and V to T and P, and that's all complicated because I got too many variables. But I'll try anyhow to show you the idea on which it works. We began with du equals the heat minus PdV. We note if we had ADB or EdZ, it will always be constant Z. If we can only get this thing to be VdP, then every time when we would have said constant volume, the other guy could have said constant pressure, and volumes would replace pressures, and pressures would replace volumes. What a nice idea. In other words, if I could write here a VdP or something instead of PdV, it would be all right. In other words, if the differential over here, which is the thing in the end, like dV and so on, that's the thing that's kept constant in this analysis, it would be nice to have that be P. Well, a clever man noticed this, that the differential of PV, the product, is PdV plus VdP, as you know how to differentiate a product. Now, adding these two equations, this brilliant man says that the differential of U plus PV is equal to dQ plus VdP. Now, in order that this thing should look exactly like the equation I had before, this stuff is given another name. It happens to be called enthalpy. Anyway, they give it a letter H. H is not the same as U, it's U plus PV. Then we have differential of H is equal to dQ plus VdP. And now we have the situation that we have over here, and we'll have all our equations copy. For instance, this equation here would become the following. The rate of change of enthalpy with respect to Z at constant temperature will equal T times the rate of change with respect to temperature at constant temperature of constant Z and pressure this time minus E. That's what we want there. And there's one more minus sign, please, because this thing has the opposite sign over here. So that's the gimmick by which it's all done. And the fundamental relationship that's the analog of this one, the one that the chemists would use instead of this one as his fundamental law from which all shall be deduced, is this, that dH, well, the rules are as follows. U goes to H. P goes to minus V. V goes to P. And you can translate that equation yourself. I'll just do one. dHd, I can't remember what it is, you see. dHdP at constant temperature is equal to T times dV dT at constant pressure minus volume. With a minus sign because it should be minus volume, you see, because there's a flip of a sign in the... But that's the chemist's equation instead of this one. It's the same idea. But I don't want any more to do this. I just want to show you how to translate. Here's the rules for translating from one system to the other. Now I would like to apply this to a number of physical situations. We're not going to do the chemical cases. We're going to do this one thing. I just did that for those who are chemists. So now we... apply this to some situations. The first situation that I would like to apply it to is the ideal gas. Well, ideal gas has this property from the kinetic theory, or you can define the ideal gas this way. If you have it at a certain temperature and you expand it and keep it at the same temperature after it's all expanded, you remember that the internal energy is the same, you see, because each atom has a certain kinetic energy and a certain internal motion, and there's the same number of atoms, and it's the same temperature after it's expanded, so that the internal energy does not depend upon volume. One definition, in fact, of an ideal gas is that U depends only on the temperature. You can put it that way, or you can say, because we're talking about T and V always, so that implies, but what I want to say, it does not depend on the volume. Well, if it doesn't depend on the volume, the rate of change of it with volume is zero. So therefore, for an ideal gas, T times dP dT at constant volume minus P equals zero. That's a differential equation to tell us something about P. Well, you may not be used to differential equations with partial derivatives, but this one is a very easy one to do. What you do is the following. This is at constant V, so you erase that and put the differential down. And then right over here, V is constant V. Everything I'm doing, the whole analysis is for constant V. Then it's an easy differential equation. You get dP over P equal dT over T if you shovel things around a bit. And it's still at constant V. if the volume is kept constant. There's a relation between pressure and temperature of this nature. If I integrate this, I get that the logarithm of the pressure is equal to the logarithm of the temperature plus a constant, if the volume is kept constant. And finally, I obtain then, by taking the anti-logs, or however you want to do it, that the pressure is equal, is proportional, is some constant or other, times the temperature, if the volume is kept constant. But we know that for an ideal gas, the pressure is equal to R times the temperature over the volume, and it checks, does it not, that with the volume kept constant, the pressure is in fact proportional to the temperature. Good, it checked. Why did I bother to do it if it checks? I'll tell you why. Because we have, in the course of these lectures, given two independent definitions of temperature. We, at one stage, to simplify things, said, let us suppose that the kinetic energy of the molecules are proportional to the temperature. That defines a scale of temperature. Let me call that the gas scale. So this is the old gas or kinetic scale. Then later, we define the temperature, and completely independently of any substance, that didn't have to be any ideal gases, by arguments of the second law, and that temperature is the absolute grand thermodynamic temperature, T. What we have discovered here is that the pressure of an ideal gas, if it's defined as one that depends only, that doesn't depend on the internal energy doesn't depend on the volume, we found that the pressure is proportional to the grand thermodynamic absolute temperature. But we also know that for such a gas, it's proportional to the temperature of the gas in the gas thermometer scheme. I mean, in the kinetic theory, let's call it the kinetic temperature, whatever you want to call it. And therefore, since they're both proportional, we could deduce that the kinetic temperature is proportional to the grand thermodynamic absolute temperature. That means, of course, that if we were sensible, we could get the same scale. And thank God, at least in that place, they did take the same scale. The proportionality constant has been chosen by man to be one. Most of the time, man chooses trouble for himself. But in this case, he made them equal. So they're equal, not only proportional, and not just a choice of scale. That's one example.
Section 45.3, the Clausius-Clapeyron equation.
Another example is in the expansion, is in the change, another application, as I'm making applications of this. Another application is in the evaporation, or rather vaporization of a liquid. I can do that from here, but it's more fun to start back there because it's even easier to understand, and I'll show you the situation. If we have a can in which we have a liquid and a greater compressor, we may ask ourselves, if we kept the temperature constant, how does the pressure vary with volume? It's not an ideal gas anymore. I'm trying to draw an isothermal now on this diagram. First, there's water down it. There's liquid here and vapor here, say water or something. Let's not, yeah, take water. Now, as you compress the piston too hard at this temperature, it'll be all water. So for sufficiently hard pressure, it's all liquid here, and the piston is here, and there we are. Now, if we squeeze till harder, the volume hardly shifts at all. In order to make the volume contract a little bit, you have a tremendous pressure. So the pressure varies very fast with volume, falls or rises with the decreasing volume very fast, until we get to a point, which we call at the place where it starts to boil if you lower the pressure a little bit more. In other words, vapor starts to form. If you lower the pressure a little bit more, it forms vapor. So we open the box a little bit, we have vapor and liquid together. And the vapor is exerting a certain pressure against the head. If I move the thing out a little bit more, all that happens is more liquid vaporizes. Why does it more liquid not vaporize now? We've talked about that as an equilibrium. The vapor's going back and the liquid's coming out. If I make more room for the vapor, I need more vapor to maintain the pressure, so a little more liquid evaporates. But the pressure remains constant, so on this curve for a long time, as I move this piston up, the pressure doesn't change, and it's called, the value of this vapor is called the vapor pressure at temperature T. This is all at constant temperature. Now, of course, it comes a time when I've got this piston so far up that there's no more water to evaporate. At that juncture, it's all gas, it's all vapor, and if I expand any further, the pressure will just fall as an ordinary gas, so that the rest of the curve looks like this, and that's at the certain temperature T. That's isothermal. Now let's do the same thing at a lower temperature. If I lower the temperature on the liquid, the pressure slightly reduced, because liquid expands with temperature. The water does. Yeah, it does, as long as the temperature is not too low. And then I have another vapor pressure, but of course when the water is colder, the vapor pressure is lower. You know, the water doesn't boil. Boils at a lower temperature, at a higher altitude where the pressures are lower. And there's another isothermal that tells the T minus delta T. Now, making a cycle out of this thing, we can connect this with some kind of complicated adiabatics and jiggles and whatnot over at this end. It doesn't make much difference. We're going to use the same argument of the Carnot cycle. It says that the heat that comes out here in changing this thing from liquid to gas is, it's got something to do with the work done, and the work done is the area in here. Let us call the heat needed to vaporize the entire stuff from liquid to gas L. That's called the latent heat. How much heat you need to vaporize, say, 1 gram of water. This is the heat, and if we multiply that by delta T over T, we should get the work. And the work, in this case, is the difference in, is the area of this thing, which is the difference in pressure times the volume change, which is the volume of the gas minus the volume of the liquid. So this work is delta P times the distance, the volume gas minus volume liquid. From which, immediately it follows that the L divided by T, well, yes, all right, times the volume of the gas minus the volume of the liquid is equal to the rate of change of the pressure. But this time it's the pressure for in equilibrium with the vapor, which I'll call the vapor pressure, with temperature. It's the equilibrium, it's the change of the vapor pressure with temperature. So you see there's a relationship between the change of the vapor pressure when the change of temperature and how much heat it requires to evaporate water. And this relationship was also deduced by Carnot, only after they finally put the right function of temperature in, and they call it, because it was deduced by Carnot, the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. I would like to quickly make an approximation to show you what kind of a behavior this implies. It isn't. First, usually the gas is very much bigger than the liquid. And we say for the volume of the gas minus the liquid is essentially the same as the volume of the gas. Now I'm approximating. This is exact, but I'm approximating. It's approximately equal to the volume of the gas, which is, if the gas is ideal, if it's a low enough temperature that the gas is ideal, the volume of a gas is for a mole, let's say a mole, RT, divided by the pressure of the gas. And the second approximation I'm going to make, which is not very good, is that L is a constant, absolutely independent of temperature, just as an example. And then we would have dP dt is equal to the constant L over RT squared P. Now, I've been solving differential equations up here too many times. I'll let you solve this differential equation. I'll let you prove that means that the P is a constant times e to the minus L over RT. And this is the nature of the pressure, that's variation with temperature, that we deduced last time from kinetic theory. Kinetic theory, we said, indicated the possibility, at least roughly, that the number of molecules of vapor above a liquid would be e to the minus the energy difference, the energy needed to pull an atom out divided by kT, or the energy needed to pull a mole apart into the gas divided by RT. This is the internal energy in the liquid minus the internal energy in the gas. And you see that these are very closely related because the pressure is nKT. So if you put this together, it's very close, but not exactly the same. However, it will turn out to be exactly the same if you change this from the rule L equals constant to the rule that the energy difference UL minus UG is constant, independent of temperature. If you do that instead of this, you'll find this rule instead of that. Just the relationship between L and the energy is easy. If I put a certain amount of heat to get from here to here, how much is the internal energy changed? The internal energy changes the heat that you put in. Take away the work that you did. And the work that you did is the pressure that's here times the volume. So L is equal to the energy plus the pressure times the volume different, times the pressure, the L is equal to the volume of gas minus volume of liquids, plus internal energy of gas minus internal energy of liquid. At any rate, it depends on which you think is more constant, L or U, which formula you get. But the main dependence is this exponential type. Now, this shows the advantages and disadvantages of thermodynamics over kinetic theory. First of all, the relationship obtained by thermodynamics here is exact, while the relationship obtained here can only be approximate, for instance, if U is nearly constant and all that the model is right. Second, we may not understand right how the gas goes into the liquid. Nevertheless, this is right, while this is only approximate. Third, although I did it for a gas going into a liquid, it's true for any other change of state. For instance, solid to liquid has the same kind of a curve. There's a time when it's melting and there's a latent heat. And then the formula is the rate of change of the P melting, pressure at which it melts with temperature, is that latent heat for melting over the temperature minus the volume of the liquid minus the volume of the solid. It's just the same idea. And we don't understand, we may not understand kinetic theory of the melting process, and nevertheless we have a correct equation. But when we can understand the kinetic theory, we have another advantage. Is all when we had all finished with this, it's only a differential relationship, we don't have any way to obtain the constants. But in the kinetic theory, we can also obtain exact values if we had a good model, if the theory of the thing was completely described, and we could obtain the constants also. So that there's advantages and disadvantages of each. When the knowledge is weak and the situation is complicated, thermodynamic relations are really the most powerful. When the situation is very simple and the theoretical analysis can be made, then it's better to try, if you can, you get more information from a definite theoretical analysis. Now I'd like to do one more example. Oh, this, incidentally, I said that this thing is really the same as this. I claim that you got everything out of here. Well, you do, really. Only here the change in volume is equal to the volume of the gas minus the volume of the liquid. The heat needed to change the volume, that's L. The volume change, that's the volume change, is equal T dP dt. It's the same thing. Now, finally, one more example, and we'll be done with this. And that is, we have discussed a box in which there's nothing but radiation. We talked about the equilibrium between oscillator and the radiation until finally we know that the box has a certain amount of radiation. In fact, we obtained a formula for the amount of energy as a function of frequency, which I've written on a top board, but I'm not going to get to it. Now, we also discussed that if there were a piston and this were a gas, considered as a gas, the photons hitting here and so forth would make a pressure. And we noticed also that the pressure, since each photon has an energy, if each photon has an energy E, its momentum of the photon is E over C. And then we worked out what that meant in terms of the collisions and found that the pressure is equal to the pressure times the volume is equal to 1/3 of the internal energy, where EU is the total energy of all the photons. These photons are generated by the oscillator. Now, if I had twice as much a volume with the same piston and everything, at the same temperature, of course, the radiation in the neighborhood of this little oscillator would have to be the same to keep it in equilibrium. This radiation, however, would be in a volume twice as big. And so we see that the total energy inside is proportional to the volume. Or another way of saying it is, if you look at the bombardment on this wall, it's the same as the fraction of this wall. The pressure depends only on the temperature. Or the internal energy per unit volume depends only on the temperature. That is, the internal energy is proportional to the volume times some function of the temperature. Well, if that's the case, at any rate, if we say that the pressure depends only on the temperature and not on the volume, then we can use that in here. We have a formula for U. U is equal to 3P, a function only of the temperature, I will remind you, times the volume. Now, sticking it in this equation, the grand equation here, we discover that du dV, keeping the temperature constant, that means the pressure constant, is 3 times the pressure. And we also know that that's equal to minus the pressure plus T dP dt. At constant volume. Well, there's another differential equation. This says that differential P is to 4P, if you put this over here, as dT is to T. Or let me put it the other way. dP over P is 4 dT over T, all at constant volume. But the pressure depends only on the volume. Doesn't depend on the volume, so you don't even have to worry about that. And so, taking log P is 4 log T, taking exponentials, P goes to the fourth power of T. So the pressure in this thing is a constant or other times the fourth power of the temperature. So the pressure of radiation goes as the fourth power of the temperature. And the energy content of the radiation, U over V, which is one-third of the pressure, also goes as the fourth power of the temperature. It's been given a constant, a name. We write U over V is equal to a certain constant, which is 4C. C is the speed of light, and sigma is a constant. And this is the name of the constant. And numerically, it's equal to this particular value. I deduced that up there in the following manner. I haven't got time to go through it exactly, but the idea is we know the intensity distribution. That is how much light there is coming in all directions at frequency nu between nu and nu plus d nu. We want the energy density. There's a slight difference between intensity, which is energy that passes a square centimeter a second, and energy, because that's a factor C in between. If there's a certain amount of energy and it goes at the speed C, then the amount that passes per square centimeter per second has a C in it. So the energy density is the same thing with a C. The total energy density, which is the total energy over the volume, must be the integral of this over all frequencies. And I'm sorry I didn't give enough time to explain everything, but if I take this distribution that we obtained before and integrate it over all frequencies, I have a complicated integral. But if I make a substitution, that h nu over kt is a variable x, then you can see, for instance, that nu, the variable nu, that is kt over hx. And every time I have a nu, I get a factor kt when I change it to x. And so the four powers of the temperature will come out here. And then I'll have an integral which will involve only x, and which is some number or other, because it doesn't have any letters inside. It turns out to be 6.4 if you do it numerically. It could be proved by great mathematicians that the integral is pi fourth over 15. At any rate, when I do the integral, I get a whole lot of constants, the Boltzmann constants and pi's and God knows what. And I finally write U over V is 4 sigma over C. The reason for writing 4 sigma over C is merely a convention for the definition of sigma. And I'd like to explain, I don't have time for that either, but here. If you had this furnace with all the heat inside and you ask yourself how much will flow through a hole of unit area per second, a tiny hole per unit area per second, it's not exactly the same as the energy density. It first must be divided by C and multiplied by C in order to get the flow, just like we undid this to get the current. And the factor one-fourth is for the following reason. First, it should be one-half, because only the energy which is flowing this way. You see, we know here there's energy flowing in all directions, and this tells you the energy flowing in all directions. So first, there's a factor one-half, because we only want the stuff that's flowing in that direction. Then there's another factor one-half, because stuff which is flowing, say, at an angle, even though it comes from this side, is less effective in getting through the hole by cosine. And when you average that out, it turns out to give an average a half. So that's why we write it this way, so that we can ultimately say that the flux from a small hole, a black hole, goes as the fourth power of the temperature. I'm sorry I haven't left myself enough time to discuss this. Perhaps I will next time. What I'm going to do mainly next time, however, is to give you an entertainment lecture for the reason that there's so much stuff in this one that it will take you more than 1 week, more than 3 days to understand it all. So while you're understanding it, we will entertain you next time with a different thing. Fail when I haven't got enough time.
Oh, that was wonderful. No problem.
That's a tough subject.